Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Next week marks the end of the current Supreme Court session, and the justices still have 12 cases left to decide and two big questions left to answer. What to do about partisan gerrymandering and what to do about the census citizenship question. Both of those cases have implications for how we draw our political boundaries and essentially how we design our representative democracy. So we're going to get into that. We also got some significant rulings this week on questions involving racial discrimination in jury selection and the government's establishment of religion. Also this week, and sometimes throughout the term so far, we heard various statements, sometimes pretty bold, from the justices about the role that precedent plays in the court's decisions. So today we're going to review what we've learned so far this term and what's at stake in the cases yet to be decided. And here with me to do that is 538 senior writer and legal reporter Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, Galen.
In theory, there's one day left for the court to deliver the 12 remaining opinions. Do we think that's going to happen?
That would be pretty crazy. I mean, it's theoretically possible. I think it's pretty unlikely that they would do that. They would be there for a really long time. And this week, they've been sort of handing down opinions in sets of four. So if that continues, we actually could have a couple more days next week at the Supreme Court where the justices continue to stretch out the end of this term as dramatically as humanly possible.
Right. So at the end of delivering the opinions for one day is when they kind of announce what they're going to do next. So on Monday, they could just say, OK, we'll also meet Tuesday. And then at the end of the day on Tuesday, they could say, OK, we'll also meet Wednesday. And then we get into overlap with the Democratic debate. So we'll try to figure out if that does happen, how to plan our podcasts accordingly. I mean, do we have a sense at this point of why the gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering and census decisions have been delayed to the very end? Is it just how it always works? What's going on?
I mean, in a sense, this is kind of how the Supreme Court has been operating for at least the past few terms. They leave these big decisions to the end. I don't know how much to read into it. I mean, clearly these are really high stakes and controversial issues, and so they still might be sort of sorting things out, writing their dissents, writing the majority opinion. They've probably already voted on the cases, but, you know, there might still be some attempts to kind of broker a compromise. I guess it's not that surprising that they're left so far to the end, but it definitely does sort of make it feel a lot more suspenseful as we're here waiting.
All right. So we are going to get into what's at stake in both of those cases, gerrymandering and the census question. But first, let's talk about what happened this week. Amelia, what were the key decisions that came down this week?
There were a few important decisions that came down yesterday and today. One, as you mentioned, is about the First Amendment prohibition on establishment of religion. It was a case about a war memorial in the shape of a cross that was put up on public land in Maryland in the 1920s to honor people who had died in World War II. And it had been challenged as a violation of the First Amendment prohibition on establishment of religion. And the reason that some people were sort of watching this case kind of closely is that now there's a 5-justice conservative majority. It could have been a chance for those justices to start really changing the way the court approaches the Establishment Clause. Right now, they have kind of a squishy test to determine when the Establishment Clause is violated, and they could have changed that, but they did not. Instead, we got a 7-2 ruling that was pretty fractured, and we can talk a little bit more about sort of what that ruling was and why it was a compromise. But then there was another case that was a death penalty appeal that you may actually have heard about if you listen to the podcast In the Dark. It's a case about a man named Curtis Flowers from Mississippi who has been tried 6 times for the same set of murders. And the question is whether his latest conviction should be thrown out because of racial discrimination in jury selection. He is Black. And in this latest trial, there were 11 white jurors and only one African-American juror. So that decision also turned out 7-2 with a slightly different coalition throwing out his conviction, saying that it was one of the jurors was struck for racially discriminatory reasons.
Let's key in on that establishment case first. What was the compromise there that led to a 7-2 decision, and who did the compromising?
The majority opinion was written by Justice Samuel Alito, but Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan were the two liberals who joined the conservatives here. So Ginsburg and Sotomayor were in dissent. And the compromise basically centered around the fact that this symbol is really old and that it's been up on public land for a long time. Alito also wrote that the cross is a Christian symbol, but it's also kind of become a symbol of people who died in World War II generally. And so it's kind of a continuation of the way the Supreme Court has approached this issue in the past, or at least the way Breyer has approached this issue in the past, which is basically to say that when these monuments are really old, it's less of a problem than monuments that say, you know, let's say someone put up a cross on public land in Maryland last year to commemorate the dead and the, you know, the war in Afghanistan or something. Like, that would be more of a problem for Breyer. So this kind of left things the way they are. And it also means that, you know, if we get another case that's involving a monument that was put up like 5 years ago, we could end up with the liberals in a different place.
And if we did end up with such a case, do we know how the conservatives would rule?
I think we can sort of suspect that the conservatives would be more okay with these symbols in general. I mean, they seem to basically be saying, you know, yes, crosses and, like, you know, a Star of David, those are religious symbols, but they can also kind of take on these general secular meanings. And, like, really, they're not forcing anyone to do anything. You know, they're just sort of out there in the world and they have meaning that is kind of separate from but connected to their religious meaning. And so really, they're not the government establishing a religion. That's sort of the basic way they seem to be approaching it. Clarence Thomas has a pretty idiosyncratic view on the Establishment Clause that he articulated again in this case, but I think the conservatives are probably unlikely to join him on.
Essentially, the Establishment Clause doesn't apply to monuments at all. It only applies to laws, and that it may not even apply to the states.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he basically says, like, you know, I really don't think the Establishment Clause should do much of anything. And I don't think the other conservatives are quite willing to go that far. But I think they're certainly, you know, if they were to get a case involving, like, you know, a Ten Commandments monument or something that was put up on public land very recently, I think we could see more of an ideological split.
Okay, so in the Flowers case that was about juror selection and racial discrimination in the juror selection process, was it some sort of compromise that bridged what seems to be a clear gap among the justices, or was the 7-2 split more just happenstance?
So the two justices who were in dissent were Thomas and Gorsuch, which means that we had Kavanaugh, Roberts, and Alito joining the liberals to throw out the death sentence and the conviction. And Kavanaugh wrote the opinion. It was a long opinion. And it sort of seemed like the conservatives' perspective was, this is a really unusual case. It was a small town. It was a very high-profile set of murders. And Alito actually said in a sort of short concurring opinion that this case is so unusual that it might have turned out differently if it hadn't just been this incredibly weird configuration of circumstances. So they basically seem to be saying, I think it wasn't, like, necessarily that there was a compromise so much as some of the conservatives just felt that this was a really unique situation, and they stressed that pretty heavily in their opinions.
And did either of these cases change precedent in any significant way?
Not really. I mean, and also, you know, to be honest, they weren't huge surprises. I mean, I think, like, especially the Cross case sort of had this potential to be a break from the way the Supreme Court has ruled on these issues in the past. But Breyer, like I said, has this history of saying that old monuments that are religious symbols are okay. So I think it was more predictable that sort of these cases were going to come down in ways that were not totally earth-shattering.
Before we get into what's to come, throughout the term, were there any other decisions or disagreements on the court that really stuck out to you?
Yeah, so I mean, this has been an interesting term because there have been these kind of culture war issues bubbling under the surface. Obviously, what's been happening in the states on abortion, with a bunch of states passing very extreme abortion bans and legislators being very explicit about the fact that they want these bans to be an opportunity for the Supreme Court to revisit its ruling in Roe versus Wade, has raised a lot of questions about whether the conservative justices want to go there, basically, if they want to think about overturning Roe versus Wade entirely, or if they want to start sort of chipping away at it around the edges, as a lot of legal scholars and court watchers think they might be more likely to do. So people were really watching what the court was going to do on abortion. There was one case involving an Indiana abortion law that the justices kept sort of not deciding on. And then they basically eventually sort of sidestepped, and they turned down an appeal that had asked the court to reinstate a state law that was banning abortions based on fetal abnormalities or the sex of the fetus. They upheld part of the same law, but basically the takeaway from that was sort of like, okay, the court is not signaling that they're ready to kind of go in guns blazing on abortion. So that was noteworthy, at least in this term. And then the other thing that was happening was there was this back and forth in several death penalty appeals. So first, the court ruled in a 5-4 vote that Alabama could go ahead with an execution of a Muslim prisoner who had been convicted, and they refused to allow his imam to be present because the state only allowed Christian ministers in the room. So that got a lot of criticism. And there were just another sort of series of death penalty sort of back and forth between the justices, and the justices kind of explaining why they had ruled the way they did. And you saw a very strong ideological divide there, with some of the conservative justices saying, you know, we're actually really fed up with the way that they think that lawyers for people who have been convicted and sentenced to death are kind of appealing and appealing and appealing and appealing at the last minute. And they're saying, you know, we really don't, like, we're getting kind of tired of this. And then the liberals sort of saying, you know, this is a matter of life and death. This is a matter of dignity. And so that was just kind of some acrimony that was bubbling below the surface. And it's like, it's always really hard to tell with Supreme Court politics. We're always kind of trying to guess at how things are going down. But that was noteworthy just because it kept coming up over several months.
There's also been, and you mentioned that a lot of court watchers and interested parties are watching the court to see how they are going to treat precedent on abortion, but also, you know, how the court is going to treat precedent broadly, because there's a stronger conservative majority now, meaning that Kennedy, of course, was a conservative, but was seen as more of a swing justice. And it seems now that conservatives as well feel like they have more of a solid majority. So what was the conversation surrounding precedent like so far this term? Were there cases where the precedent was really upended? And even if not, what was that conversation like? Because I know that some of the justices were kind of taking jabs at each other over the issue.
Yeah, they totally were. I mean, and this came up in a bunch of different decisions, sort of, you know, sometimes cases involving precedent actually being overruled, and some just in cases where it wasn't overruled, and certain justices, and I mean, really Clarence Thomas, would say, you know, I really think we should revisit precedent, or why are we paying so much attention to precedent? So we actually had a ruling in a case today that overturned a precedent with a 5-4 majority. And Kavanaugh was the deciding vote in that case. And Elena Kagan sort of had one of these jabs in her, in a dissenting opinion, where she was basically saying, you know, what is the court going to do next? What precedent are they going to overturn next? And in a couple other cases, Clarence Thomas has really stood out on this and saying, basically, if something's wrong, it's wrong, and precedent should not keep us from, you know, overturning something that is incorrect. And that, I mean, you know, for people who follow, like, the idea of precedent is, like, basically judges are unelected, they can serve lifetime terms, and I think it kind of promises a little bit of certainty to people who, or just to anyone in the legal system, this idea that sort of we're building on what's come before. And Thomas has never really taken that view, so I think it's not that surprising that he's coming out and saying this now, but it is interesting because the liberals seem really concerned about precedents being overturned.
But, I mean, if you listen to Democratic politicians, they, you know, call for overturning precedent all the time, Citizens United being one example. So, I mean, is overturning precedent really that unique, or it's just like one side or the other is freaking out about it based on the makeup of the court?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's totally true that courts that have been controlled by liberals in the past have overturned precedent. And it's still unusual to do it. I mean, the court is not doing, I think the court has done it twice now in this term, which, you know, is significant whenever it happens, but it's not like they're doing this in every other ruling. I think the reason that it's just coming up so much now is just because of what you said, that for a long time, the court has had this very delicate balance between liberals and conservatives, and then sort of Anthony Kennedy being kind of the fulcrum in the center. And now the conservatives really are in a position to start getting rid of precedents they don't like. And so, you know, would liberals do this if they were in the majority? Maybe. I think this is just another way that the liberals are kind of trying to signal what could happen now that the conservatives are in control. So I guess it's not necessarily surprising, but it's very important.
You have also been throughout this term tracking the various coalitions on each Supreme Court decision to see kind of who's siding with who, where the lines get drawn in this new court. What did you see any trends among the justices?
I want to caveat this by saying we have 12 cases left, and that is a lot of cases. So this could all change. But I think one thing that is probably unlikely to change and has been pretty noteworthy is that Kavanaugh and Roberts have been ruling together a lot. And that is noteworthy for anyone who kind of wants to know where Kavanaugh might go in the future. I mean, it's possible that Kavanaugh also just wanted to have a term, you know, after his extremely high-profile, rather explosive confirmation hearings, he just wanted to have a term where he was not making headlines or, like, didn't want to rock the boat. And so he's been voting a lot with Roberts, and he's also been voting a fair amount with Alito. So the three of them have been showing up a lot. Gorsuch, who is obviously Trump's other nominee, has been a little bit more of a loose cannon on the conservative side. He's voted with Justice Ginsburg a couple of times, including a case earlier this week where they were the only two people in dissent. So that is sort of interesting. Again, could change depending on what happens next week, but that's something I'm watching, where Gorsuch will end up when all of the numbers are tallied from this term. And the other thing I've been watching are close decisions. So decisions that were decided by a very narrow margin. And there we've seen, most of them have been decided along ideological lines by the conservative majority, but according to what I've seen, actually all of the conservatives have swung to the liberals in at least one case, which is interesting to see as well. Just if you think about what the liberals are trying to do, they may be trying to work out compromises with different conservative members of the court, basically acknowledging that they're in the minority and they just kind of need to peel off one person from the other side to get a ruling they're okay with. So it'll be interesting to see again how that turns out after next week. We could get a bunch of rulings that are just 5-4 rulings with the liberals on one side and the conservatives on the other. But so far, that's an interesting trend.
Kind of a talking point or narrative at the beginning of the term was that Roberts cares a lot about the court as an institution and how it's viewed by the public. He was concerned about Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings, etc., and was intent on, you know, spending the term or maybe next couple terms focusing on trying to not have the court seem too partisan, too divided, etc., etc. In the kind of your tallying and looking at the different coalitions so far, and of course, again, we have 12 decisions left, does it seem like that has held true, that Roberts is trying to piece together these maybe narrow decisions, not trying to be too bold, trying to find consensus where he can so that people don't view the court as coming out of the gate of a very partisan confirmation, then just kind of diving into that same partisanship?
Yeah, I think, I mean, at least so far, I think we do see some of that with Roberts and Kavanaugh together, because again, they were ruling together a whole lot. And so you see them ruling more with the liberals or a little more with the liberals than the other conservative justices. But again, I mean, I just don't think that's a question we can answer until next week, because they're still waiting on these two cases that have huge implications for partisan politics. And that's kind of, you know, that's going to kind of be the bottom line, the talking point from this term. So, you know, whatever they've done up till this point is important and I think does tell us something about the way that Roberts and Kavanaugh are approaching this kind of new reality. But that's just a really, really important set of data points we don't have yet.
Well, and to that point, let's talk about the stakes involved in those two cases. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. It's the middle of the night. You're tossing and turning, not sleeping, drenched, covered in sweat. Sure, running the AC or a fan all night can help a bit, but to sleep really cool and comfortable, you have to get rid of your heat-trapping mattress and get a Casper mattress. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night, all summer long. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. Casper has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try out your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper. Try yours for 100 nights with free shipping and returns. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics. Code politics and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Additional terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. We're back, and of the 12 cases left to be decided this term, there are two that we are really keen in on, and they're especially significant topics for us at 538 because they have to do with elections and representation and counting and maps and numbers, and those are the partisan gerrymandering case and the citizenship question on the census. Let's begin with gerrymandering. Amelia, why is this back at the Supreme Court this term after being at the court last year as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's back. The court punted on this last term. They had these two cases, and they rejected them for sort of procedural reasons, so they weren't getting at the meat of the question, which is, can a partisan gerrymander be so extreme that it's unconstitutional, and what would that look like? Do we have a standard for that? So now we have two cases back, and these cases are just going to keep bouncing back to the Supreme Court because there's an automatic appeal from the three-judge federal panels that decide them. So, you know, as long as the Supreme Court says this is something the courts can deal with, they are going to keep getting these appeals and keep having to deal with them. And so the cases this year, there's one out of Maryland involving a gerrymander by Democrats, and there's one out of North Carolina involving a gerrymander by Republicans.
People who've been listening to the podcast for a while know that this is a topic that we've keyed in on, and we've talked about the case in Wisconsin, which was at the court last year, but, you know, is still in the pipes making its way back up. Depending on how the ruling goes in these two cases, it may never make its way back. But essentially what they're trying to figure out here is, one, is this a question that the courts can even decide? Is it a political question, meaning if they want to change something, it has to be the legislatures and not the courts? And then if it is something that's up to the courts, how to deal with it exactly? And basically, Kennedy said, yeah, the courts can deal with this. We just don't have a good way to deal with it. So we're going to like leave it on the back burner and you come back to us when you have a good plan for how to measure gerrymandering and decide when it goes too far. Of course, Kennedy's not there anymore. And so now we're all kind of waiting to see what Kavanaugh thinks about partisan gerrymandering and even whether the courts can weigh in on it or if it's just a political question.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting changes from last term. The question of whether the court should get into this at all is much more of a live issue. It seems much more possible this year that the Supreme Court might just say, you know what, this is a political question. The court shouldn't be dealing with this. Please never bother with us with this again. And we had a chat about gerrymandering earlier this week that's on the site that folks should check out, but we talked about that a bit. And so I think even though like it's the same issue and it's almost the same court, the fact that Kavanaugh is there seems to have kind of changed at least what I see as the possible or likely range of outcomes here a little bit.
For sure. And when it comes to the practicalities of what such a decision would mean going forward, right? If the courts say, this is a political issue, never come back to us again about this, it means that in 2021, when state legislatures across the country draw political maps with the new census data, they basically have free rein to do what they want, unless those individual states create laws or unless Congress passes a law, which probably won't happen, regarding partisan gerrymandering. They basically do what they want, and they don't have to worry about ending up back at the Supreme Court defending their maps, having to potentially redraw them, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I would say one thing. One thing we could see happening more is states can pass laws, states can change the way they do things. People can also sue under state constitutions. So that's another thing we could see happening, is that people might still keep trying to go to the courts with this, and it would just be state courts that would have to be deciding.
Absolutely, and that's what happened in Pennsylvania last year. The state Supreme Court ruled that it was a violation of Pennsylvania's specific state constitution, which is different. Of course, the provisions about how elections are conducted in their constitution are different than the U.S. Constitution, and they got those maps redrawn, and as a result, Democrats gained a bunch of seats in the midterms in Pennsylvania. And yeah, I mean, talking to reformers, definitely they have their sights set on state constitutions and then also ballot initiatives where voters can vote to institute a bipartisan commission or nonpartisan commission or whatever you want to call it, which has its own issues. And you can hear about them in the gerrymandering project, which you can find wherever you listen to your podcast. We've talked about it plenty. But we should also just mention that there are a couple other possibilities here, right? The Supreme Court could more or less punt again. They could maintain the position they're in now where they say it is possible that someday the Supreme Court will rule that extreme partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. We have not yet found a standard, and we're still looking for it. And that preserves the status quo more or less, but what the court would be saying in that case is that all of the legal theories, all of the math, the tests that you've developed up until this point do not suffice, which basically means like go back to your books, figure out something else entirely, and come back to us when you have a new plan, a new way to measure everything.
Yeah, which would be also pretty dramatic, just given, I mean, and this is something you've covered and I've covered, just the wide range of options that the court is being presented with this time. I mean, if they say that none of these options that they've been given suffice, that's a pretty big deal, too, because they are being given a lot of options here. And I would just say the one other thing they could do is they could strike one of these gerrymanders down as unconstitutional, but set the bar very high. And sort of one way that I could see that happening is that in North Carolina in particular, the legislators basically came out and said, we're Republicans, we're in control, we're going to draw these districts so that we get a certain number of seats because we're Republicans and we want to stay in control. And that is pretty much as blatant as you can get in terms of sort of saying why you are doing this gerrymander. And so theoretically, it's possible they could say, okay, that was unconstitutional, but it's unconstitutional because they said out loud in those words, we are Republicans and we are doing a Republican gerrymander to hurt Democrats. And so then, you know, if that becomes the standard, then if you're a legislator, you're just like, okay, well, I'm just not going to say out loud what I'm doing, and business continues as usual.
Right. All of these possibilities are pretty interesting. Of course, they could set the standard there. If they do rule that partisan gerrymandering can be unconstitutional, they can set the standard basically wherever they want. But
they can, you know, do what they want.
They can do whatever they want. We are going to find out soon enough. And of course, we'll be back talking about it when we do have a decision in hand. But lastly, the citizenship question on the census is also yet to be decided. What is at stake in that case?
So at stake in this case is a couple of different things. Basically, there are a couple ways that the question has been challenged. So the backstory is essentially that the Trump administration wants to add an 11th question to the questionnaire that goes out to everyone in the country and will go out in 2020 saying, are you a citizen or not? And this has been challenged both as sort of a violation of the laws that govern the way administrative agencies work, because there are allegations that basically they're not being honest about why they're adding the question, and they didn't do this in the proper way. They sort of didn't listen to the experts in the way that they should have. And so what they did is just illegal. And then there's a kind of deeper argument that's being made in some of the cases that's sort of about whether the question itself is unconstitutional. So there are like kind of two layers here. There's whether the way the Trump administration did this is illegal, and then there's whether the question itself is unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily need to answer both of those questions. But what's at stake is basically that this question, according to demographers and social scientists and the Census Bureau itself, is that the question could result in some people, certain groups of people, namely undocumented people, immigrants, Hispanic people, not responding to the census and therefore not being counted. And that is really, really important because census data underpins like basically every aspect of American life, including the way our political representation is distributed. So if you are undercounting one group more than another, that has really serious implications for the way all kinds of resources and funding and representation is distributed. So that is a really big deal if it happens. The issue is that we don't really know what will happen because this question has kind of been rushed onto the census and the Census Bureau hasn't done all of the testing that it would normally do. So it is a little bit of a black box. There has been a lot of hypothesizing about what the impact will be, and I think it is pretty hard to find like a demographer or social scientist who will say that they don't think that this will have some kind of differential impact on immigrants or Hispanic people who are basically afraid that this data is going to be used against them in some way by the government. But exactly the scale of that impact, we don't know.
Yeah, I guess the question I have there is the 2010 census was considered a pretty well-conducted census, but even in 2010, without this question on the census, were people who were in the country illegally responding to the census? You know, if they were generally skeptical of government agencies and sort of, as Obama framed it, as kind of like living in the shadows, would they be answering the census in the first place? Do we have data on that?
So that's an incredibly hard question to answer. I think the bigger concern here is that, like, yes, as you point out, sort of distrust in institutions and government institutions has been rising generally, and that affects the way people see, you know, the census coming and asking for their personal information. The census does have ways to estimate basically how accurate they were, and they do see that basically people of color are more likely to be undercounted. And the concern here is that this question is going to take a problem we already have, which is that we are overcounting white people and undercounting people of color, and basically put that problem on steroids. Like, it's just going to be, there are going to be far fewer Hispanic people in particular responding to the census. And that would include people who are here in the country legally, people who are citizens, maybe people who are in families, like mixed status families. So, you know, they might be here in the country legally, or they might be a citizen, but they have a family member who's not here legally, or, you know, they're here, like refugees might not respond to the question. So I think the concern is sort of essentially that this is going to turbocharge a problem that is already visible in the data.
And so, as you mentioned, one of the things that's at stake here is apportionment, basically how many congressional districts a state gets based on their population. And that's been talked about a lot. Something that hasn't been talked about quite as much until actually maybe more recently, when a GOP map drawer's personal files were uncovered, and we can get into that a little bit. Basically, after he passed away, his daughter gave them to Common Cause, and now they've been making their way into this court case. But essentially, the other aspect here is that some Republicans have shown interest in drawing congressional districts and state legislative districts based on citizen population and not total population, meaning that, like, once apportionment is over and you know how many congressional districts you have, then you can go and draw those districts based on only people who are allowed to vote and not total population, like children, prisoners, people who are undocumented, etc.
Yeah, and So I think it's important to say, you know, not every state would try to do this. There are a handful of states, including Texas, where legislators have seemed like they're interested in doing this. And, you know, again, it's one of these things where it's a little hard to predict exactly how this would happen. But basically, we know that Democratic-leaning districts are more likely to have non-citizens in them than Republican districts. This is especially true in states like Texas. And so if you take all of those non-citizens out of the count, it would make it easier for Republican legislators to redraw districts in a way that would sort of, they would be able to draw more rural districts, basically, and draw fewer urban districts because there would be fewer people in urban districts that they had to count. So this could theoretically be a huge deal for redistricting and for, you know, basically for sort of entrenching Republican power in certain states even further, if they're allowed to do it, which is a big if. If a state tried to do this, it would end up right back at the Supreme Court.
Right. And it's worth saying that this is also a somewhat philosophical question about the way that our democracy is supposed to work. Like, essentially, people who support the idea of drawing districts based on only the people who are eligible to vote are saying, you know, if we have one person, one vote, if everyone's vote is supposed to count equally, then the districts have to be equalized based on how many people are able to vote in each district. Otherwise, somebody who lives in a district with people who are not eligible to vote, their vote is worth more than people who live in a district where it's mostly only people who are eligible to vote, right? And so that's kind of the complaint. And then on the other side, you say, well, in a representative democracy, we need to make sure that every representative is representing the same number of people. So there is like philosophical debate going on here. It's also worth saying, though, that this GOP map drawer's files that were uncovered, Tom Hoefeler, basically did the math to figure out that this would ultimately end up helping Republicans and was promoting this idea based on its ability to help Republicans get elected and not necessarily the philosophical argument about how our representative democracy should work.
Right. And it also, he also appears to have been involved in the push to get the citizenship question on the census. So part of what he was saying in this study that was just uncovered, right, is, you know, to be able to do this, we need citizenship data, and we don't have good data right now, or we don't have data that's good enough to use for redistricting. So, like, we really need to get this question on the census, because the census is, you know, a survey that goes out to literally everyone, very high quality. So this is the thing we have to do first. And he appears to have been somewhat involved in that. So that's kind of another sort of late-breaking twist that has happened with the release of these documents. And the Supreme Court could take that into account if they want to. It's kind of unclear whether they will, and that'll be another interesting thing to see next week. You know, we sort of see this playing out also in the lower courts where trial judges have ruled on this, and they're sort of being asked to take this into account. And so it's just kind of a complicating factor that this late evidence has been introduced, and I mean, I'll be really interested to see how the Supreme Court deals with it.
All right. Well, at this point on both of these questions, partisan gerrymandering and the citizenship census question, we have nothing left to do but wait. So that is what we're going to do. And whenever these decisions do come down, we will have some analysis for you. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining me, Amelia.
Of course. It was a delight.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.